Connectability Radio presents the DSTO Information Series, Major Life Transitions, held May 14, 2009. From One Generation to Another, moderated by Brenda Rothenberg, with panelists Ken Beck, Shirley Jamuska, Sharon Brown, and Orbo Endicott.
Okay, so we're going to get started. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the third session, third and final session of Different Life Transitions. This session is going to be focusing on the transfer of responsibility and decision-making from one generation to the next. I think all families who have special needs are on a lifelong journey. At every stage of this journey, the future of their children, when they are no longer around, is resting in some place in their minds. As the children get older, and as the parents start aging, their children's future moves to the front of their minds. Our session will feature two individual experiences, transferring responsibility for well-being and care from the parents to the next generation. We will also hear from Orgo Endicott, who will give us a brief overview of best practices in preparing for that transfer. So I'm going to introduce all of the panelists before they start, so we can have a smooth transition from one to the next. I'll start with the end. Shirley Jamuska is Sharon's sister. From 1979 until the year 2000, Shirley worked at Community Living Toronto. In the last 10 years, as assistant supervisor at ETS in North Care. Sharon and Shirley have lived together since 1990 after their mother passed away. Prior to assuming full responsibility for Sharon, Shirley was always very much involved in Sharon's life. This is Sharon, Sharon Brown, and today is Sharon's birthday, so we really appreciate you coming. Sharon, as I have said, is with Shirley. She goes to ETS 3 days a week and keeps pretty busy on the other 2 days. Sharon loves going to dinner and enjoys going to theater with her sister Shirley. Ken Beck is Norman's older brother. Norman's not with us today. Ken is a former board member and presently chairperson of the Learning and Development Committee of RENA. Ken has been involved with RENA since the mid-1980s when his family faced the beginning of the transition from the family home to a group home for his brother Norm. In addition to his personal experience with transitions, Ken brings experience regarding family decisions and dynamics through his former work as a teacher, school principal, and government official. Now last but not least, we're really pleased to have Orville Endicott here. And Orville, I'll give you a little bit of information about Orville. Orville was called to the Bar of Ontario in 1978. He became legal counsel to the Canadian Association for Community Living that year, and continued in that capacity until 1993. He now serves as part-time legal counsel to Community Living Ontario and as a legal consultant to various other disability-related organizations. Mr. Endicott has been involved in some of the leading court cases, human rights hearings, and inquests dealing with the rights of persons with intellectual disabilities. Mr. Endicott is also involved in novel legal and social approaches to the provision of housing and financial security for persons who would otherwise be completely dependent on service systems, if they were available, for their residential placement and for their social and material well-being. Mr. Endicott has supported the movement for legislative reforms in many areas of the law and was involved in the process of gaining the entrenchment of the equality rights of persons with disabilities in Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So we look forward to hearing from Endicott. And we're going to start with, actually, we're going to start with Ken. So Ken, if you could give us a little bit about your story, that would be good.
Okay. Thanks very much, Brenda. I thought I'd start with just a bit of a history about my brother and gradually work into the transition, and I'll try not to make this too long. So let's start. My brother is younger than myself, and I'm his only sibling. And he was born in Peterborough. And when he was very young, of course, my mother used to compare him to me in terms of growth and development. And she kept noticing that, you know, something was not the same let's put it that way. The doctors kept saying nothing was wrong, but finally he was diagnosed with Down syndrome. And we got to remember now, this is the 1940s, late 1940s, when services were really not available. And in fact, people who were developmentally delayed could not even get an education at that time. The ministry offered absolutely nothing. The only thing that was available were institutions such as Huronia and so on. My parents decided to keep Norm at home, and this went on until he was about 9 or 10 years old, and finally the doctors convinced her that he should go into an institution. In this particular case, it happened to be Huronia. When he went in, he was a talkative, cheerful kid. And in those days, they didn't let you visit for 3 months. After 3 months, my parents went back to see him. He had running sores. He had stopped talking. He had lost all kinds of weight. So they pulled him out. And basically, they became very involved themselves with a number of other parents in the Peterborough area in founding, I think, what was called the Peterborough Association for Retarded Children. And so they opened a school, and then eventually they moved on to opening a sheltered workshop, which my brother was also involved in. And again, he lived at home at that time. I'm going to skip now to when they moved to Toronto in the early 1980s. And when they moved to Toronto, he was involved with Community Living Toronto, and I think it was a different name in those days. They keep changing the names and so on. And not to protect the identity, they just keep changing the names. In any case, he became involved with Community Living Toronto. My family is Jewish, and my parents were fairly, I wouldn't say outwardly, overly religious, but were very interested in a faith-based organization. And even though he was involved with Community Living Toronto, they wanted him to be more involved, I think, with a Jewish organization, which is why they got involved with RENA, a faith-based Jewish organization, although open to people of all faiths and religions. In any case, he was involved in the day program there. He switched from Toronto to the RENA daycare program, and they had a daycare program then. I think it was on Dufflaw, called the Dufflaw Center in Toronto. By the mid-1980s, my parents were getting on. They were in their mid to late 70s. And my wife at the time and myself started to talk about what happens if my parents pass away. So we started talking with RENA, and a social worker was involved, and really saying, you know, the best situation for our family if something happened, because now they were getting close to 80, was that he could possibly move into a group home. He was not high functioning, but, you know, good kid and functioning okay, but not really high functioning, where he could live alone under supervision in a community living situation. He needed a group home. And of course, in those days, there were very few group homes, but the ministry came along and finally said, we will have some group homes. And my parents were very apprehensive. He had lived at home, of course, all of his life. He was in his early 40s then. My father was really quite afraid, because he thought, if he goes into a group home, will there be fighting going on? So he was very afraid of interpersonal reactions. Not that my brother is a very docile guy, but he was always afraid of others, that there would be a fight and so on and so forth. Of course, that never happened. And eventually, through a series of family group discussions and so on, in those days, when RENA first started that, I believe you had to sit through group discussions, and they were social workers watching you through one-way glass and the rest of it. And this went on. That doesn't happen any longer, but we went through quite a number of sessions. And my kids who were probably 11 and 12 at the time, were also involved in these family sessions. So it really was family. My parents, Norm, my kids, my ex-wife, and so on. So we were all involved. At that point in time, he did get into a group home, and that was 1988. They opened a number of group homes in 1988, so my brother got into the group home. In 1989, my mother had a series of strokes, so she was in and out of hospital. My father seemed to be okay, and they were now 82 and 83 years of age. My father seemed okay, but in 1989 there was quite a serious flu. Not as bad as SARS, but it hit a number of seniors. And both of them were hit with that flu at the same time, and he ended up in hospital. And unfortunately, he passed away very quickly. He was there for maybe a week, and overnight, he just went. So there my father was gone, and again, my mother had a series of strokes. My brother was now in a group home. 6 months later, that was in December of 1989, that my father passed away. In June of 1990, in 6 months, my mother passed away. So within 6 months, both parents were gone. And I keep saying to myself, if we hadn't talked about a group home, what would have happened? The important point here was that there had been previous planning, and that transition period is very, very important in terms of looking at what's ahead and what are going to be the results of what happens. So Norm went into the group home. My parents, by the way, and this is important, never spoke to me about taking on responsibility for Norm. Never. In fact, they said, we don't want you to have the responsibility. But the reality is, he's my brother, and it is my responsibility, really, to see that he's okay. And that basically is where it went. I visited frequently at RENA, eventually, because I was quite involved, became a member of the board and a number of different committees, and I'm still involved as a chairperson of the committee. I've told my kids that Norman is not their responsibility, but it's very interesting. When I go away and my wife goes away and we're on vacation, it's my kids who will call the house. They'll take Norm out for lunch or dinner or whatever. And I have always told them they don't have to do this, but they do. So it almost, it's something that continues. So it's their involvement that's important. One of the things that I wanted to mention before I forget is that the transition for my brother was incredibly easy when he went to the group home. In fact, when I was talking to my son about this last night, he said he found that Norm was more expressive when he moved to the group home than he was at home. So he made that transition very, very easily, and it was wonderful, really. The bottom line basically is, and I'll shut up in a second, we do what we can and have to do to make life as good as possible for everyone. There's no one perfect solution unless we have endless amounts of money. For the rest of us, we can be so thankful that organizations like RENA exist so that we can ensure that we are doing our very best for our family members who need that help. And again, remember that a gradual transition and planning is really important. Thanks.
I'm going to ask Shirley to speak. You know, I hadn't met Shirley until today, but we've had a number of phone conversations. And when I heard that Sharon had been living with Shirley and Shirley was completely responsible for Sharon's care, I told Shirley that she was 1 in a million. So I'm going to let her tell her story.
Thank you very much for having me today for to tell my story. Sharon came into my life on this day 59 years ago. After having begged my mom and dad for years for a baby sister or even a brother. But by the time Sharon arrived, I was of the opinion that my parents didn't do those things. Our family doctor did not inform the family that Sharon had Down syndrome, as he didn't think she would make her first year. She had many health problems. And isn't it amazing, here she is today. We can all be wrong. When Sharon was about 3.5 years old and not walking, and my mother was ill, and I had finished school and was starting on my life in the working world, the decision was made to place Sharon in Aurelia Regional Center. She stayed there for about 4 years, and they did have her walking in about 6 months. But no one at home was happy with her living situation, and Sharon always knew where home was. I was engaged by this time, and my parents, my future husband, and myself decided to bring her home, and we promised my parents that we would help when we could. And Sharon arrived home and started at Beverly Street School half days till she was 12. And as you said, there wasn't that much at that time. We had Beverly Street School and a residence next door to it where you could have parent relief for a few days. She had wonderful teachers, though, and loved school. When Sharon was 17, our father passed away very suddenly, and Sharon and my mother came to live with us. We lived in Oakville so that was 1967. Sharon has been with me most of my life. Sharon and we lived in Oakville, where Sharon completed school and joined the Oakville Community Living Workshop, and I joined as a volunteer. We returned to Toronto, and Sharon became an employee of North York ETS, which started out on Birch Avenue and moved to a new location on Steep Rock Avenue in North York in 1972. I joined the staff of North York ETS in 1979 as an instructor and became the assistant supervisor sometime later. The transition from my parents' hand to mine was effortless, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Sharon and I have our moments, as all siblings do. But we get over it. My hope is to look out for Sharon as long as possible. We share household chores and some expenses. We enjoy going to plays, eating out, and in the summer, a friend's pool. Sharon does needlework, knits, and has just taken up painting and beading. And so she keeps herself really occupied. We're close enough in age that we're growing old together, and will someday probably check into the old folks' home. It has never occurred to me to have Sharon go to an apartment on her own or to a group home. And this is our story, and I know that... That is the story of how I have become the next generation to being her guardian. Trust me, it has been an interesting and fulfilling ride. Sharon has been my inspiration.
Thank you. That's your amazing story. And now, your turn.
I had to look up Shirley's name on these envelopes. I saw my name on the top one. I'm sure it's stuffed with $1,000 bills.
No first coupon.
Okay, well, it's my pleasure to be here with you. It's certainly been my pleasure to hear these stories. They're, in the case of these families, they were definitely trips down memory lane. Back to another age. An age when, unfortunately, thousands of people in this province were placed in places like the Huronia Regional Center. We had 16 of them. And it's just a little over a month ago that the last three were finally closed. And it was a cause of great celebration. And certainly... Ken, when I heard you speak about your brother's experience at Huronia for, you didn't say how long. We can only hope it was...
3 months.
3 months.
3 months, okay. You did say, and I just didn't register. 3 months was enough for Norm, wasn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah, it sounds horrific. Anyway, I don't want I don't want to talk about the distant past. You've heard about that. You've heard how smooth that those transitions were in the case of the two families represented by the other panelists. But I think we have to now be as realistic as we can about what the future holds. And I'm assuming that there are people in this room who could tell their own stories about transition, and I'm sure there are people in this room who are preparing for transition and maybe having some qualms about how it's going to work and if it's going to work. And you know, when I'm through talking and you're through asking me questions, asking them questions, it's still going to be up to you to answer the question how it's going to work. Because I can only offer, I suppose, what might be called a checklist of things that have to work. The brochure, which is pretty much all I have to go on about what your expectations are, talked about transferring responsibility for the care and well-being from parents to the next generation. Well, what does the word responsibility mean in this context? I'm going to be talking about three areas of at least potential responsibility. I'm going to be talking about responsibility for making decisions. I'm going to be talking about responsibility for financial matters. And I'm going to be talking about responsibility for arranging and monitoring supports and services. But I think it should be clear from the beginning that those of you who are siblings or other close family members, but not parents, do not now, nor have you ever had direct legal responsibility unless you went out and got it. In other words, if you became guardians, and surely you used the word guardian, are you the legal guardian?
Yes.
Okay. Because sometimes people use it sort of with a small g, and it means more. Means more to them in terms of caring and protection than it does in its strict legal sense of having decision-making authority. Craig Shields, who invited me to join you today, is somebody whom I haven't known for a year yet. In fact, I think it was probably in the early fall, Craig, that you and I met for the first time. And we met, and we probably wouldn't have met till this day, had it not been for an example of the most egregious irresponsibility of a sibling to her sister who had a disability. And I'm talking about the case of Tiffany Pinckney, a woman who had autism and who was systematically starved and dehydrated in her sister's basement until she died. And the sister, quite rightly, was found guilty of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 9 years in penitentiary. Now, you know, I suppose there is a continuum from total responsibility to total irresponsibility. And I have to assume that everybody in this room is very much towards the other end of that continuum, that you have a sense of personal responsibility, even though the truth is, as your parents said to you, Ken, you don't have to do this. You're doing it. What I was going to say, and I'll say it anyway, you're doing it out of the goodness of your heart. Now, sometimes we use that phrase, the goodness of your heart, as though it's sort of meaningless, that you just fall into a situation, you're not getting rewarded for it, so everybody says you're doing it out of the goodness of your heart. But, you know, look at those words, and the heart has its goodness. And you've experienced the goodness of being family. You've experienced the goodness of having someone with whom you don't always get along, as Shirley confessed. And possibly you've experienced it even though it's been costly for you in some ways. You know, I'm not going to ask Ken to give any accounting, but I would be willing to bet that he would be a richer man today financially had it not been for having a brother called Norm. Don't nod your head, because we don't want to go there. I'm just saying that, you know, estates are divided up. I have four children. My will says they each get a quarter. Anyway, let's go into those specific areas of responsibility, and I want to be through in time that we can have some dialogue as well. Well, first of all, responsibility for decision making. When anyone becomes a parent, the law gives them full responsibility to make decisions for and on behalf of their children while their children are children. And this is a heavy responsibility. We've seen recently, almost on a daily basis in the media, about one set of parents, and the father in particular, of a little baby called Kaylee. And he felt that he had a responsibility to make a decision to give her heart away, because the doctors led him and the mother to believe that Kaylee would not survive because of the particular syndrome that she had. And, you know, legally, he had the authority to make that decision. I don't like to say the right to make it, because when you say that somebody has a right, you have to consider possible conflicting rights that someone else has. But generally speaking, parents have the authority and legal responsibility to make decisions involving the welfare of their children, whether those children have a disability or not. Now, I've been working in this field for 30 years, and hardly a month goes by that I'm not confronted with parents who really believe that responsibility never goes away if the child has an intellectual disability. Well, in fact, it does. And the law is that once you, in this province, turn 18, you are deemed to be capable of making your own decisions. I remember writing a letter to my son on his 18th birthday, telling him, guess what? Now you have the ability, I'm free of the responsibility, and you can make your own decisions. Well, guess what? He'd been doing that for 5 or 6 more years. I can't remember exactly how long. Still does, in spite of my advice. Now, there is one area of the law where not only parents, but siblings and other relatives do have the authority to make decisions about various things. And that is set out in a statute of Ontario called the Health Care Consent Act. And there is sort of a ladder of people who have that authority. And if there's somebody else higher on the ladder than you, then you don't have that authority, unless that person either abdicates the authority or is not available for some reason. And it starts with the Shirleys, who have legal guardianship of the individual. And now we're talking here about adults, okay, who have disabilities, and not necessarily defined by the courts, as rendering them incapable of making decisions, but disabilities that a physician or another care provider feels makes it risky for that doctor to accept a consent from the individual who needs the medical care. So the doctor is entitled to turn, as Norm's doctor can turn to you, did you know that, to give consent to medical care. You didn't? Okay. Well, obviously Norm is living a very healthy life, or those circumstances would have raised their heads by now. The guardian is at the top of the list. Then if somebody's been given a power of attorney for personal care, and I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think there's quite a lot of misunderstanding about what a power of attorney is. A power of attorney is very much like guardianship, except that in the case of guardianship, the court says, okay, you can make decisions for this individual. A power of attorney would be one where Norm would say to Ken, you can make this decision for me. I don't know Norm, but one of the things that has to be asked is, does the person have the mental capacity to give or grant a power of attorney? And very often that's not the case. And you know, I get these documents that are 10 or 12 pages long, supposedly granting a power of attorney from a person with a disability to a sibling or somebody else, usually a sibling. And, you know, I just know it's not worth the paper it's written on, because the person, and I get this from other evidence, didn't have a clue what he or she was doing. So please don't say you are have power of attorney, and it's expressed in different ways, but don't say it unless it's true. And don't go through the charade of having somebody put an X or write his or her name at the end of the power of attorney if they really don't know what they're doing, because in law that's what we call a nullity. It's worth nothing. Okay. Now, you're going to have questions about whether then you should say to the court, make me a guardian, since Norm can't grant me power of attorney. There are a lot of reasons to avoid that route. First of all, it means that your sibling has to be defined on strong evidence as somebody who lacks capacity. And they've already been labeled in a lot of ways. And do you want to add another label? I think you should only do that if it really becomes apparent to you that there is no alternative, that the person's well-being will be at serious risk if you don't. There are other alternatives, and those alternatives are sort of emerging even as we speak. Guardianship and powers of attorney come under the heading of substitute decision making. And as one government lawyer once said, the individual who becomes the guardian takes the place of the individual. You are a substitute. Well, nobody can really be a substitute for somebody else, because if they are, they've turned that somebody else into a legal non-person, in a sense. And I said what's emerging is an awareness that there can be supportive decision-making. as an alternative to substitute decision making. Now, I'd like to be able to point to a statute of Ontario, like I did the Health Care Consent Act, and say, here's where you find it. Well, it's not quite as simple as that, because it doesn't yet exist in the statutes of Ontario. I've said to some people, March 31st marked the closure of those huge institutions where people were warehoused and they were cared for, but they didn't have a life. I'm looking forward to another March 31st where we'll be able to say to people, now you can honestly say, I will support Sharon to make her decisions rather than be her substitute. And, you know, I could go on all afternoon, and I only have another 5 minutes if there's going to be some doubt. So I'm not going to talk more about responsibility for decision making unless you want me to, when we open it up for questions. Responsibility for financial affairs is, I guess, primarily a responsibility to become informed about what's available. Not too long ago, everybody knew what FBA was. Remember FBA, Family Benefits Act? That's been gone now for over 10 years. We have now ODSP, and everybody knows what ODSP means, the Ontario Disability Support Program. And people like Norm, who is living not with family, is now, I presume, receiving a monthly income of $1,020, which is not a big deal, but he never gets his hands on all that money, does he? It goes to the group home, and some of it is strictly regarded as Norm's allowance, and it's supposed to be used, you know, ideally by him. But again, as I say, I don't know him, whether he can make decisions about what he might want to buy with, I think it's, how much is it? $120 or so out of the $1,020. It's sometimes called a comfort allowance. Now, Sharon, in your case, and I'm just using you as an example, and I don't want you to answer my question, or the implied question. I presume living with your sister means you don't get $1,020 a month. You get $700 and something, which is better than nothing, and still better, actually, than people who are on Ontario Works, who are financially needy but don't have a disability. They only get $500 and something a month, even if they're totally on their own, which boggles the mind how people can survive on that. Now, the other thing that you should know, and in on this checklist of things that you want to know as you go into this transition, or you anticipate going into it, is that there are other sources of income that your sibling can have access to. One, of course, is employment income. And, you know, some people can work and earn money, others can't. Some can work only for a short period of time. But if you work and earn income, automatically ODSP adds another $100 to what they give you. If you work and earn income, you're allowed to what it works out to is you're allowed to keep half of what you earn. What it in fact means, you can keep all of what you earn, but for every $100 that you earn, your ODSP check drops by $50. So, you know, there are issues with that, but that's the way it is. So that's earned income, and then there's unearned income, in other words, gifts, and that's why I'm saying Ken isn't as wealthy a man as he would otherwise be, because he's been giving Norm money over the years. I'm making this up, you know. Don't shake your head one way or the other. Because I only met Ken about an hour ago, so I'm just using. I hope they'll forgive me using them as hypotheticals, because hypotheticals don't have flesh and blood, and these people do. But you know, again, there is a possibility, and I'm not asking Ken to say yes or no, that when his parents died, they left money in their will, both for Ken and for Norm, which is what people ordinarily do. Now, the money left for the Norms in Ontario can and should be left in what's called an absolute discretionary trust. We have a short nickname for an absolute discretionary trust, and it's called a Henson Trust. And it's named after a family that invented it. Lover Boyer invented it, let's be honest, but they were the ones who took advantage of this thing, which the courts have said any amount can be left in a Henson Trust for the family member who has a disability, and it will not have any impact whatsoever on their entitlement to receive benefits, except that the amount of money they can receive by way of a gift, either from that trust or from a sibling or other relative, is currently limited to $6,000 a year. Now, if you're making just over $1,000 a month, that $6,000 a year raises your income by almost 50%, doesn't it? So that's significant if it's available. And as I say, it doesn't reduce your eligibility for ODSP benefits. I want to just make sure you know about the Registered Disability Savings Plan, which is a brand new thing introduced by the federal government, not the Ontario government. But the Ontario government has said, you can use this plan and we will ignore it in terms of what ODSP benefits you're entitled to. And to make a long story short, if a person with a disability, whether it's intellectual, physical, or whatever, if a person with a disability that entitles them to the disability tax credit, which means they have to clear certain hurdles under the Income Tax Act, but if somehow family, individual, together can scrape together $1,500 a year and put that in a Registered Disability Savings Plan, believe it or not, the federal government, in some cases, depending on family income — now Norm's family income doesn't include yours — so Norm's family income would be such that if there is $1,500 of private money deposited in that account, the federal government will throw in $4,500, so that every year, for an investment of $1,500, you walk away with $6,000. Don't I wish that I could invest money at that rate of return, but none of us can. Except and until the RDSP came into effect. The RDSP has issues with it that I really don't have time to talk about. One is that if you don't have what the federal legislation calls contractual competence, then you have to go through the process the person who wants to set up the plan for you has to have the legal authority. And surely you would certainly have the legal authority, being Sharon's guardian, to set up a plan. Maybe you've already done it. And the deadline is passed for the first year, 2008. People had till March the 2nd, 2009. if you want to, if you didn't get it started then, you want to get it started for 2009. It's not like the RDS or the RRSP that every year goes into the next year, and the deadline is the end of February or early March. The deadline for the Registered Disability Savings Plan for 2009 will be December 31st, 2009. So think about it and ask questions about it if you want. Now, the final thing that I said I was going to talk about, and I've really used up more time than I should have, is the responsibility for arranging and monitoring supports and services. You know, we've heard testimony from my other panelists about how they have done that, both in terms of directly keeping tabs on what's happening to their sibling. In Ken's case, not only that, but being part of the governance of the organization to which Ken's well-being is entrusted. So that's sort of going the second mile. I want you to know and write down, if you don't already have it engraved in your mind, that we are about to embark on a new system of government-funded supports for people with intellectual disabilities in this province. And what we're calling it is the Social Inclusion Act. It has a much longer name than that, but the key meaning of the legislation is that from henceforth, funding for supports and services is only legitimate if it promotes the social inclusion of your brothers and sisters. And that's something that gives you as siblings, and particularly if you are at the point of transition, you should know that the province is also at the point of transition to a new system. A new system that will not do away with the RENA group homes. They'll still be funded, and you know there are some 300 organizations around the province who provide group living accommodation. And whether that's in every case a good thing, it's a subject for another event. But the other thing that the Social Inclusion Act introduces for the first time, we're waiting until sometime later this month to see what the regulations are going to actually say about how this can happen. But the Social Inclusion Act provides for direct funding so that people do not have to go cap in hand to an agency, so that they can have a life with the supports they need designed by them rather than designed for them by the agency. Or they can have a combination of direct funding and agency funding if they can work that out. So think about person-directed planning.
I think I'll wrap it up. First of all, I want to thank Shirley, Sharon, and Norm for sharing your personal journeys with us. I'm sure that everyone will take away something valuable from your stories. And thank you very much for giving us so much useful information. Thank you.